This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign minister says the country opposes the deployment of foreign forces in the Caucasus, saying it is a common concern for all regional countries. Another Palestinian youth loses his life after being critically wounded by Israeli forces during a raid west of the occupied West Bank city of Salfit. And the British opposition leader slams the country's prime minister, saying her government no longer has a mandate from the British people. Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to World News. And now, Iran has rejected the presence of foreign forces in the Caucasus, saying it is a common concern for all regional countries. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comment in a phone call with his Azerbaijani counterpart, Jehun Bayramov. Now, he added that Tehran is against any deployment of foreign forces to the Caucasus region. Amir Abdollahian said Iran follows the principled policy of respecting the national sovereignty and territorial integrity of countries. He was referring to age-old border disputes between Azerbaijan and Armenia, Iran's call for peaceful settlement of the differences between the two countries. Now, the two of them have been engaged in a decades-long dispute over the Nagorno-Karabakh region, which at times has led to armed conflicts. The latest flare-up of tensions between the two neighbors took place last month. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the country's nuclear industry is now invulnerable to sabotage and adversaries have no option but to engage in diplomacy. We discussed this issue earlier in our news review program. News review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. In our top story, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the country's nuclear industry is now almost impenetrable to sabotage attempts. Spokesman Behruz Kamalvandi says that Iran's adversaries have no option but to engage in diplomacy regarding Iran's nuclear activities. Spokesman also touched on recent tensions with the International Atomic Energy Agency, accusing it of issuing politically motivated reports that have portrayed a tarnished image of Iran in the global arena. An official added that the body's demands are excessive and cannot be implemented due to anti-Iran sanctions. The IAEA has recently asked Tehran to explain that what it calls the existence of nuclear material at undeclared sites in the country. Iran says that that question is based on false information provided by the Israeli regime. Joining us now is Robert Fantina, author and journalist out of Kitchener, Ontario, and Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, joining us from New York. Gentlemen, I would like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there, Daniel, with you in New York. Now, Daniel, if it's impenetrable, the country's nuclear program now, how does that change the equation?
Well, if it's truly impenetrable, then it changes it, because it means that the Iranian nuclear program will go forward, and there will be nothing that the West will be able to do short of sitting down in a serious way and renegotiating the JCPOA and re-entering into that agreement. But that's assuming that those claims are correct.
Right. And Robert, welcome to the program. I'm going to put that same question to you. We know that most of the sabotage attacks and even threats of military flyovers on nuclear sites originated and mostly came from the Israeli regime. So how does this change the equation if they don't know where to hit, or if it's so far deep down under the ground that once they do hit it, nothing really will happen for the Iranians? How does this change things?
Well, it only changes them in the fact that such attacks will not impact the nuclear facilities. It won't prevent Israel from bombing areas in Iran that it thinks Iran might have such facilities. And this, of course, it will be done with the complete support of the United States. But it does mean that the United States has to be serious about renegotiating and re-entering the JCPOA, not with additional conditions, not with additional or reduced amounts of sanction relief. The Iranian government is now saying that it has a nuclear program that can't be touched. If the United States wants to know what's going on in Iran, wants some level of transparency, which Iran is under no obligation to provide, then the United States has to seriously, as Mr. Lazar said, return to the negotiating table with intent, not with threats, not with intimidation, but with something to offer Iran if it wants something in return. This new announcement today that the nuclear facilities are impenetrable should motivate the West to be more serious about its negotiations.
Now, one thing, Daniel, that Iran wanted to get in return for a revival of the JCPOA was the fact for the IAEA to leave this issue of these undeclared sites, the information provided to it by the Israeli regime, leave this issue alone, and wants the U.S. to ask the IAEA, and basically the U.S. is saying we have nothing to do with the IAEA and we cannot interfere in this, but nevertheless, Iran wants this investigation stopped, a complete revival and back to trans, complete eyes on the ground for the West in Iran on its nuclear facilities. And Iran is willing to do all that, but it wants, do you see that getting shored up? Why or why not?
No, I think it's a very important issue. And I think that that Iran's concerns are absolutely correct. I mean, it's quite bizarre. I mean, the Israeli government, which is not even a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, is somehow feeding information to the IAEA, and which is then using that information to threaten Iran with essentially an unending, ceaseless, infinite investigation into the most flimsiest cases involving long ago nuclear research. I mean, it makes no sense. I mean, Iran is quite right to be concerned that it'll be dragged into an Alice in Wonderland kind of procedure in which it's presumed guilty. And will have to prove its own innocence. The West is very good at using these techniques to throw Iran on the defensive, to throw it off balance. And Iran is quite correct that it doesn't want to be set up in this kind of way.
Now, Robert, from your perspective, When heads hear this latest story coming out from the Iranian government in the White House or at the Pentagon, do you think they're thinking to themselves at this point, we need to take JCPOA negotiations more seriously? Or do you think they're thinking, heck, we need to build a bigger bomb that gets that far down into those bunkers?
I think the latter, unfortunately. The United States is not known for diplomacy. It's only known for invasion, overthrow, regime change, violence, brutal oppression around the world. So the fact that the Iranian government is saying that its nuclear facilities are impenetrable is going to cause the United States to say, well, we're going to figure out how to penetrate them. Another point I'd like to make is that Iran has asked for the end of the IAEA investigation into these sites that Israel is accusing it of. And the United States said it has no say in that the IAEA is independent. The United States has say in everything it wants to have say in. So it can certainly influence any aspect of the United Nations, the IAEA, or any other organization to do its bidding if it wants to. This is a case where it's taking a hands-off approach because it wants to continue to harass Iran with these useless investigations. So we're seeing, again, U.S. hypocrisy in action.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us in the program there. Robert Fantina joining us from Kitchener, Ontario, and Daniel Lazar joining us out of New York. That's a wrap for the segment to your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Iranian officials say the situation is under control at Tehran's Evin prison, where a fire broke out earlier in the day. According to authorities, firefighters put out the blaze, which broke out in one of the prison wars. It followed a brawl among a number of prisoners convicted of financial crimes and theft. Gunshots and explosions were heard. At least 8 people have been injured during the incident, which it caused no deaths. Evin prison is located in the northern part of the Iranian capital. A Palestinian youth has succumbed to injuries he sustained during an attack by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Salfit. 31-year-old Mujahid Ahmed Mohammed Daoud died after he was critically shot in the chest by Israeli forces early Saturday. He was rushed to a hospital in Ramallah, where he was pronounced dead. Tensions have been running high across the occupied territories in recent months. The Israeli military is pressing on with its crackdown against Palestinians following a series of deadly attacks. Resistance groups say the attacks are in response to Israel's atrocities. Nearly 170 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank since start of the year, 15 in October alone. A protest was held in the besieged Gaza Strip following Friday prayers to support Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ashraf Shannon has your details.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has held a big protest in the Gaza Strip to condemn the surge of Israeli attacks in Al-Quds and on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. People thronged the streets of the blockaded territory following the Friday prayer to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and asserted that armed resistance is the key to reaching freedom.
We condemn the Zionists' provocations in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we salute the freedom fighters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Today, we're entering a new era where armed resistance against Zionist occupiers is the strategic choice, not only in Gaza, but also in the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, and everywhere in Palestine.
Protesters also expressed their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression and attacks. Palestinians in Gaza have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. Occupied by Israeli forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
Al-Quds is the core of our struggle against the Zionist enemy, and we are willing to die in order to protect it. Zionist forces and settlers are skirting Al-Aqsa, and we must escalate the resistance against the Zionist occupiers.
This is while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Palestinians here are calling for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israeli plots over Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
British opposition leaders lashed out at the ruling Tory party over the country's current economic crisis. Starmer says the Prime Minister is unable to fix the chaos she caused after unveiling her economic growth package last month.
The worst decade for growth in two centuries. The vicious cycle of stagnation, as the now former Chancellor calls it. And there's still one person clinging on, the Prime Minister. No doubt we'll hear plenty of laughable excuses in the coming days. After 12 years of stagnation, that's all her party has left. But even they know she can't fix the mess that she's created. And deep down, her MPs know something else. They no longer have a mandate from the British people.
Keir Starmer also accused the Tories of putting the party before the British people. His comments came a day after Truss fired Kwasi Kwarteng as Chancellor of the Exchequer and replaced him with former Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt. She also once again scrapped parts of her tax-slashing mini-budget that sent markets into turmoil and caused uproar even in her own ruling Conservative Party. Hunt has signaled a U-turn, though, on Truss's unpopular economic plan.
It was a mistake to cut the top rate of tax at a period when we were asking everyone to make sacrifices. And it was a mistake to fly blind and not to back up the economic plans that were announced with an independent forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility.
Hunt acknowledged that tax increases were on the cards, but added Britons want more than anything else is stability, including political one. He said he never wanted to, or he needs to deliver on these expectations. Hunt is due to announce the government's medium-term budget plan on October 31st. It'll be a key test of his ability to show investors that the UK can restore economic credibility. The country is grappling with high inflation and slow economic growth that's raised fears of a recession. U.S. House Committee investigating the Capitol riot of January 6, 2021, has decided to subpoena ex-President Donald Trump. Few expect Trump will ever testify, but the decision keeps the 2020 election unrest front and center for next month's midterms. Rami Mazahiri has your details from Chicago.
Less than 4 weeks before the United States midterm legislative elections, the committee investigating the election-related protests on January 6, 2021, announced that they will subpoena ex-President Donald Trump to testify. However, most analysts believe Trump will not ultimately testify, and his written response to the panel was noncommittal. Trump has reportedly been telling aides he favors testifying as long as it would be done in a live public hearing, but the commission isn't likely to agree to that. Almost 2 years after the presidential election, the country appears to be as divided as ever, with Trump supporters calling the subpoena an October surprise meant to influence the midterms, while anti-Trump partisans say the subpoena proves that not even an ex-president is above the law. The January 6th committee has been alternatively branded as a necessary defense of American-style democracy or as a staged show trial. What appears certain, however, is that it has had seemingly no effect on the American public. In poll numbers, which are virtually unchanged despite nearly 2 years of intense mainstream media focus on the committee, 35% of America still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% of the country still calls it an insurrection. Over 60% of Republicans still believe the 2020 election was illegitimate. In 2017, polls showed that over 60% of Democrats still believed the 2016 election was illegitimate. America's political division did not begin on January 6, 2021, and it does not appear that the committee will fully unite the nation by voting day on November 8th. The news of the subpoena was announced on what many say was likely the commission's last public hearing. The final report is expected shortly after the elections. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
India, Singapore, and the Philippines are among those building new labs certified as biosafety level 3 or above. But some researchers worry about the cost and risks. In this regard, we have provided an exclusive article published in Nature. Stay tuned, please. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, plans are afoot to build more than 40 high-level biosafety labs around the world, including in India, the Philippines, and Singapore. Investments in biosafety labs often follow major epidemics, but some researchers are concerned about the growing number of facilities that will handle some of the world's most dangerous pathogens. Some scientists worry about the huge cost of maintaining biosafety level 3 and BSL-4 facilities, whereas others fear the risks posed by these labs, such as the possibility of creating pathogens that are more dangerous or of microorganisms escaping. But researchers in the countries that plan to build these labs say they are needed. The lack of high security labs in some regions became particularly apparent during the pandemic because work on the live virus that causes COVID-19 SARS-CoV-2 must be done at a BSL-3 or BSL-4 facility. The pandemic exposed the weakness of health systems worldwide in recognizing and responding to emerging threats in public health, said Bharati Pawar, India's Minister for Health and Family Welfare, at the ceremony to mark the start of construction of one of the nation's new BSL-3 labs in Bengaluru last month. India's plans are among the most ambitious. The country is in the process of building 5 BSL-3 facilities and is planning at least another 9 more. 4 institutions have also said they will construct BSL-4 labs with the highest level of containment too. India currently only has 1 such facility that is operational, and the government has committed to building 4 new national institutes of virology, 2 of which will also eventually handle BSL-4 pathogens. BSL-3 labs are designed so that scientists can safely work with potentially lethal and inhalable pathogens in a contained environment. Experiments are conducted in sealed workspaces in which the air is filtered and not recirculated, and the entrance to the facility is typically secured by self-closing doors. BSL-4 facilities in which researchers work with fatal pathogens that can spread through aerosols and for which vaccines or treatments are lacking or limited require extra security measures. These labs are isolated from other sections of a building and have a dedicated air supply, and researchers change clothes and shower before entering and leaving the premises. The pandemic has raised public awareness of emerging diseases and the need for labs, creating a favorable environment for these investments, says Pragaya Yadav, a virologist who heads the BSL-4 facility at the National Institute of Virology in Pune. A country India's size needs more high containment facilities, she says. Elsewhere in Asia, Kazakhstan, Singapore, and the Philippines have announced plans to build their first BSL-4 facilities. Beyond the region, the United States has committed to adding another BSL-4 lab to its existing group of about a dozen maximum containment facilities. And Russia announced last year that it will build 15 BSL-4 labs. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, plans to build 27 BSL-4 labs have been announced worldwide, say Gregory Koblenz, a biodefense researcher at George Mason University in Arlington, Virginia, and Philippa Lensos, a biosecurity researcher at King College London, who have tracked the number and distribution of BSL-4 facilities globally. But some researchers question the need for so many extra BSL-3 and BSL-4 labs and note the hefty cost of maintaining them. Ilich Mombo, a virologist at the International Center for Medical Research of France, while in Gabon says that roughly 10% of his lab's budget goes on experiments, whereas around 90% is spent on checking, maintaining, and repairing the facility. When instruments break, they cost a lot to fix, and there are no trained technicians in the region. Researchers are sometimes sent to work elsewhere, says Mumbo. Thomas Kiozik, a virologist who heads the high contaminant operation at the Galveston National Lab in Texas, a BSL-4 facility, says that his team's lab receives close to $12 million a year from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases just for maintenance and operations, some $2 million of which is spent on 24-hour security, and about $2 million is required to power the ventilation, heating, and air conditioning, as well as to operate the BSL-3 portion of the lab. Rohani Navarro, a vet at Philippines National Institute of Molecular Biology and Biotechnology in Manila, says she and her colleagues are constantly writing grant applications just to maintain their BSL-3 operations. She says the annual certification, which involves a thorough safety review, costs some $40,000. High contaminant facilities can become like a white elephant that isn't used. Some researchers also worry that having more of these labs will increase the risks associated with them, including of workers being infected. Scientists say labs often struggle to find well-trained staff to run high containment facilities. Kim Sells, who researches health policy and health systems at the nonprofit organization Alliance for Improving Health Outcomes in Manila, says in a survey of lab practices in the Philippines, found that biosafety officers had only a weak understanding of biosafety. More labs could also lead to more high-risk research, such as gain-of-function studies, in which pathogens are sometimes modified, which could make them more dangerous to people. A large body of evidence suggests that SARS-CoV-2 jumped to humans from wild animals, probably at a live animal market. But some scientists say they cannot exclude the possibility that the pandemic started with an enhanced virus that escaped from a lab, raising broader concerns about the risks of gain-of-function research. But some scientists say new biosafety labs could lead to better safety practices. These labs help researchers work more safely than they could without them, says Gigi Grovel, a biosecurity scientist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, adding, "Assuming that people are trained well and equipment is updated, I am not concerned by the array of BSL-3 labs."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakh Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to your show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Dr. Fakh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
Today we want to talk about an important concept in Islam, and that is waqf, or it's better roughly translated into endowments, Islamic endowment. Let's start first with the definition of waqf and the role that it has in a Muslim land society. Sheikh Rouhani, what is waqf exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Waqf has four rukns or four pillars. Mm-hmm. One is the sighatul waqf, the way that you say the wordings of waqf. Mm-hmm. When you, for example, do waqf, you have to say special kind of sentences or words according to which you do the waqf. The second thing is the thing that you do waqf on, that or that you embow to the others.
Okay.
And so these rukns are important that should be there. So, and also waqf is something that you distribute, we can say tharwa, or we can say money among the people freely for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
It means it's a kind of distribution of the tharwa among people. So that's why the role of waqf is really significant. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes you see that nowadays in modern societies, we have some classes of the people who are so much rich, and then we have numberless people who are homeless people.
Yes.
It seems that this economical system cannot solve the problem of these homeless people.
Yes.
But in Islam, there are some solutions for these kind of problems. What is one of them is waqf, that when you are, for example, when you have this capacity or capability to do something as waqf, you can do it for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and help the poor people to get a better, let's say, quality of life.
That's right.
I think that's why waqf is, even nowadays, is very much important. And its role in establishing brotherhood, or like, yes, let's say a kind of prosperous life for all the members of the society, it is important.
So whatever you have as a personal property can be endowed, yeah, in the way of Islam in order to help or contribute to the, we can say, the life and the lifestyle of the people, especially the Muslims in the land, isn't it?
Yeah, of course, because... Okay. If the number of the poor people increase in society,
yes,
of course, the more the numbers increase, the more you will have unsafe kind of society. Mm-hmm. Because these poor people will create lots of problems for the rich people.
That's right.
That's why it is a best solution for even for the rich people to have a peaceful life.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. Okay, Dr. Fakhwani, what about you, brother? How do you define waqf, and what are the main categories of waqf?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It seems that the basic philosophy behind waqf is that everybody, especially those people who are capable of doing something eternal and good to Muslim community, and I mean in a larger scale to human community, should try to minimize the burden problems of the poor people.
Yes.
For example, when there's a rich person and he is capable of establishing, for example, a school or a library or a hospital, he is encouraged to do so. Granted that that's, I mean, rich person pays off his homes annually, or, for example, is attentive to the needs of other people, yet establishing something like, for example, a hospital, a library, a school, or anything else,
yes,
makes it more memorable.
Yes.
And in this way, we find that the air or the condition of larger socio-economic cooperation, mm-hmm, and integrity becomes very much established,
yes,
in that society.
Okay.
Okay,
that's right.
This is one. And another point in this regard is that in the Islamic religion, not only in the individual relation of people with God is emphasized, rather the social integration of people on the one side and their integration and their connection with God is highly emphasized in this regard.
That's right.
So when someone establishes a mosque, mm-hmm, a Hosseinia, a library,
a hospital, yes,
okay,
a school, that's right,
or for example anything else for public welfare,
yes,
donates it in the cause of God,
yes,
for the posterity,
yes,
for the public,
mm-hmm,
it teaches other people that, okay, he hasn't been oblivious of the needs of the of other people,
that's
and
right.
This is one. And another, mm-hmm, one is that as people want to be remembered in a good way,
mm-hmm,
okay, we find that the name of the donor,
yes,
is mentioned,
yes,
okay, and even to some extent, centuries after,
yes,
the death of that important person, his name is still shining over.
Yes,
there.
That's right.
Yes.
Especially when it is a school, university, or hospital, we,
yes,
could see the names we can say all our crosses. Some of them, of course, we can say on purpose, do not want their names to be disclosed, you know, and secretly this donation or we can say allocation or endowment is done. But as you said, sometimes the amount of the waqf or endowment or the number of the places, we can say, and the properties are so many that an organization, and in some Muslim lands, we can say a ministry is established in order to take care of the
imam. And to regulate.
And to regulate, in fact, the affairs of the people. It shows important. It's really like a ministry in some of the countries, which shows the importance of the endowment on waqf. And so many people benefit, really. So many Muslims benefit from the endowment. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, what more do you have for us?
Yes, one of the really important points that should be taken into consideration while talking about waqf or khums or zakat, these kind of things. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's a kind of text kind of system. We consider it like modern kind of text system or taxation. But the main difference here between Islamic kind of texts or this kind of paying khums or zakat, these kind of things, is this, that paying khums, paying zakat, or let's say paying waqf or doing waqf, is a kind of ibadah, is a kind of worship.
Yes.
In addition mm-hmm. to that kind of economical aspect, yes. it has a kind of a spiritual aspect and dimension that should be also taken into consideration. That is why there are lots of rewards mm-hmm. for waqf, for the yes. one who do waqf.
Yes, yes.
Not only in this life, but also in the hereafter life, okay. we have lots of rewards for these kind of people. So that's why sometimes Muslims might ask that, okay, we pay, for example, tax for the governments. Then why should we pay again? Why yes. should we do waqf? Why should okay. we pay again khums or zakat?
Okay.
We should remember that this is a kind of ibadah. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of worship.
Yes.
So, of course, these mawqufat or these kind of payments that we have,
yes.
of course, they have its own, let's say, earthly effects or kind yes. of, in this world, they have
benefits,
its own effects and
right.
benefits.
Yes.
But of course, what matters most here is the hereafter life, that mm-hmm. in that life, you will be rewarded. You will be enjoying the, let's say, outcomes of this waqf that you did in this life.
That's right.
For eternal life. Mm-hmm. It would be kind of eternal kind of rewards that
yes.
you will receive.
That's right.
Why it's very significant for us to be aware of the importance of waqf in our lives.
As you said, because it is a kind of a body work, we can say spiritual, religious work, so there are some conditions, we can say, about the property, authenticity of the property, purity of the property, we can say the pure intention of the waqf or the endower, we can say, and all these cases has to be taken into account. It is not like, for example, I don't know, the surplus or the money that you put in a bank, and at the end of the month you got the interest, and the interest higher, you know, the higher the interest is, the higher would be the waqf that you put on the market. No, this is not so. And a person who is after, we can say, doing waqf, has to be religiously pure. His halal income has to be taken into account. And there are so many details to be taken into account when they are doing a waqf.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Dr. Fakhwani, you are a scholar, you are a professor at the university. Can, for example, a person endows his books somewhere as a waqf or something like that. I don't know. For example, you have a specific or precious books, for example, or manuscripts. Can you do waqf on them?
Yes. Actually, for a bibliophile or for a lover of books, mm-hmm. it's really not very hard, but it's a kind of sacrifice okay. for such a person to donate his personal books that he has collected over the years okay. to another place. In this regard,
would you do it yourself?
Yes, I've already endowed, I've already donated thousands of my books to the libraries of Imam Hussein's Holy Shrine.
Uh-huh.
Yes, very okay. fine books.
That's right.
And I'm very proud of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel very happy in this regard.
Okay.
But...
So how is the process is being done? I mean, when you do a waqf book, for example,
yes,
to the library of Imam al-Hussein. Just
yes,
give us
actually,
a picture.
I take a pen and I write on the title page of the book or mm-hmm. somewhere, I mean, appropriate on the book that... This book has been donated to the library of Imam Hussein's Holy Shrine.
Do you write it in English?
Yeah, in English or in Arabic.
Well, what do you say in Arabic?
No, it's equivalent in Arabic.
Okay. I know. What do you write on the title
page? Yeah, I write, waqf ala maktabat al-imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
That's all.
And that's all. Okay.
This
and
is a kind of waqf name, isn't
it? No. Waqf name is something totally different.
What is it?
Of course, it's a formal letter.
Uh-huh,
okay?
It's a formal
letter. It must have a beginning, a main text, and a conclusion. But in order to donate a book, okay, mm-hmm. I mean, in this way, okay, it isn't that much, hard. Yet, it must be indicated that, to my knowledge, at least tens of important people, yes. not only from Iraq, but also from other countries, even from the United States,
okay.
donated their personal libraries to the library of Imam al-Hussein's Holy Shrine in Karbala.
That's all okay? right. Okay.
And our purpose, not only mine, mm-hmm. but those of other, donors of books to yes. the library, this was our shared or common interest yes. or common, purpose that after our lives in this world, still our books will uh-huh. be, will
the
prove helpful,
yes,
for the posterity.
Okay. okay.
At the same time, it must be indicated that, yes, it can be done with regard to one's books. However, as Sheikh Rouhani is present here, nobody is entitled to donate all his, possessions, yes. so just a certain portion. Yes. Okay. It has a certain, percentage, mm-hmm. a certain percentage of one's properties can be donated to a certain place because, okay. It shouldn't deprive my children, for example, my wife and my children of
yes.
my own properties.
Yes, okay?
They do have some rights in this regard.
Yes.
So
okay.
I have to calculate, for example, these books I don't need anymore or, for example, of these books,
okay.
I have several copies. Okay,
so you have to observe justice among
certainly.
The family members and your...
Rationality is the
right.
basic criterion in this regard.
That's all right.
Yes.
That's really beautiful. And in this way, I think so many problems of the Muslim lands will be solved. Like, for example, poverty, lack of housing, helping the people in order to get married, young people especially, providing the dowries for the new girls who want to potentially get married, and so many other problems of the Muslim lands with the help of the administration and the government. This is important. Because in this case, as I heard in so many Muslim lands in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, in Islamic Republic of Iran, in Bahrain, in Iraq, we have so many big organizations in order to take care of the endowment and the waqf of the society. And I think they can help a lot because the people who want to do endowment trust them, give them the right power. And this giving power, we can say, is really important over here. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, what about you? Any other function of the waqf can you mention for us in the society?
Yeah, of course. One of the really important point here that should be mentioned is that sometimes we might mistakenly assume that when you do waqf or imbow something for the other people, it's a kind of loss. But you see, while it is a kind of income that you have for yourself,
huh.
both spiritually and as I mentioned, also economically and let's say in this worldly life. So that is why for our people, for Muslims, it's really important that nowadays they should take it into account that they should do waqf, because waqf, as Dr. rightly mentioned, there's no need to endow all your properties.
Yes.
Just part of it, but the good influences or the positive, let's say, impacts that it has on the lives of you yourself, mm-hmm. I mean, the waqf, and also your society, your people, your relatives, and the poor people, and also the rewards that it has for your hereafter life. We should consider all these different aspects and dimensions of waqf.
That's right.
And do it for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay. So this way, of course, we can solve lots of problems,
yes.
particularly for the youth, for the young generations who have lots of problems nowadays in different countries.
In order to be more familiar with the concept of waqf, I would like to introduce some books for you over here. Ahkam al-Waqf fi Shariat al-Islamiyya, written by Muhammad Obaid al-Kubaisi, has been also translated into Persian language. Based on the ideas and the fatwas of different denominations inside Islam, the concept of waqf has been tackled. Al-Mustalahat al-Waqfiyya, written by Ubaidullah Atiqi and Khalid Shu'aib, and this is another book. And also Ayatollah Jafar Subhani has written an outstanding book, Ahkam al-Waqf fi Shariat al-Islamiyya. This is again an outstanding book of which I invite dear listeners to go and visit and read out these books. And all in all, I could say that waqf and the public endowment and a specific endowment in Islam can really help to take care of the affairs of the Muslims, not only in your Islamic land, but all across the world. You know, it helps you to take care of the people and the poor Muslims and the people who are under the oppression all around the world. Thank you very much, Dr. Farhwani.
Welcome.
For a nice elaboration and explaining your experience of waqf. I'm Sheikh Rouhani. Thank you very much, too.
Thank you very much.
And dear listener, thank you very much, too, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/EN.
Limelight. British Prime Minister Liz Truss has faced severe criticisms over her foreign policies and handling of domestic economic problems. This has caused her popularity to drop at home. One of the things that has made her face a lot of criticism is her firm support for the Zionist occupying regime of Israel and also her attempt to move the British embassy from Tel Aviv to the occupied city of Al-Quds. We take a look at some of the world press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Palestine Chronicle website has more on this story. British Prime Minister Liz Truss described herself as a huge Zionist and a huge supporter of Israel during a meeting with a pro-Israeli Tory parliamentary group recently. Liz Truss was a guest of honour at the Conservative Friends of Israel event during the annual Tory Party conference in Birmingham, which she was attending for the first time in her new capacity as Prime Minister. According to footage of her remarks published on social media sites, talking to a crowd on the sidelines of the event, she declared her unwavering commitment to Israel. She told the cheering attendees, "As you know, I'm a huge Zionist, I'm a huge supporter of Israel, and I know that we can take the UK-Israel relationship from strength to strength." The Conservative Friends of Israel itself focused on part of her speech in which she referred to threats from authoritarian regimes who don't believe in freedom and democracy, against which two free democracies, the United Kingdom and Israel, need to stand shoulder to shoulder. Liz Truss's position on Israel is well known, and she promoted it during her campaign to become the new Conservative leader and Prime Minister. Among the policy changes that she pledged to effect in office was to review the relocation of the British Embassy from Tel Aviv to the occupied city of Al-Quds. Former US President Donald Trump did the same thing during his time in office. The British Prime Minister made the same promise recently during a meeting with her Israeli counterpart, Yair Lapid, on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly meeting in New York. Pro-Palestinian groups and the Palestinian leadership have condemned this idea. The website of the Middle East Monitor has more on the same story. The Palestinian Hamas resistance movement has censured British Prime Minister Liz Truss for calling herself a huge Zionist who wants to strengthen London's relationship with Tel Aviv, saying the comments are in line with the United Kingdom's 1917 Balfour Declaration, which set the stage for the creation of the Israeli regime in occupied Palestinian lands. Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri made the statement. He said, "Her statements about supporting Zionism mean she's standing at the Zionist regime's side and supporting aggression against the Palestinian nation." Sami Abu Zuhri added that such remarks are in line with British crimes which began more than 100 years ago with the Balfour Declaration against the Palestinian cause, which is fighting off the Israeli occupation. The Hamas official said, "Britain's Prime Minister was one of those who covered up the killing of innocent children," adding, "This is shameful for humanity." The Balfour Declaration came in the form of a letter from Britain's then Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour, addressed to Lionel Walter Rothschild, a figurehead of the British Jewish community. It was published on 2nd of November 1917. The declaration was made during the First World War and was included in the terms of the British Mandate for Palestine after the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire. It is widely seen as the precursor to the 1948 Palestinian Nakba, when Zionist armed paramilitary groups, who were trained and created to fight side by side with the British in the Second World War, forcibly expelled more than 750,000 Palestinians from their homeland. Press TV's website has more on the same story. Recently, British Prime Minister Liz Truss told the Israeli regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid that she was considering transferring the British embassy in Tel Aviv to the occupied city of Al-Quds. If this happens, the contentious policy shift would be similar to that of the United States under former President Donald Trump in May of 2018. Angered by British Prime Minister's announcement, the Palestinians described the statements as a new Balfour Declaration by Britain and said it proves Britain's bias in favour of Israel. The Gaza-based Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement both condemned reports about moving of the British embassy to the occupied city of Al-Quds. Hamas spokesperson Abdel Latif Qanou said at the time, "The announcement by the British Prime Minister Liz Truss about her intention to move the British embassy to the occupied city of Al-Quds is a flagrant bias towards the occupying Israeli regime." He warned that the move would not give Israel any legitimacy over 1 inch of Palestinian land. Hazem Qassem, another Hamas spokesman, warned that moving or relocating the British embassy to the occupied city of Al-Quds would be considered as a new crime by Britain against the Palestinian nation. A senior official from the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, Mohammad Shala, accused Britain of continuing to display arrogance against Palestinians. Mohammad Shala said, "We are not surprised by what Britain is doing in the light of the ongoing Arab and Islamic silence." He added, "We blame the Arab and Islamic countries that are supposed to support Al-Quds." Another Palestinian Islamic Jihad official, Tariq Salmi, warned that the controversial British plan would anger Arabs and Muslims. He denounced the move as a hideous colonial aggression against Palestinians, adding that Britain is directly responsible for the tragedy of the Palestinian people. The Israeli regime lays claim to the entire city of Al-Quds, but the international community views the city's eastern sector as occupied territory, and Palestinians consider it the capital of a future Palestinian state. Liz Truss's approval rating sank to a new low of 47% in an observer poll published on Sunday, 9th of October. Her popularity is lower than that of Boris Johnson, at the nadir of his political career, and is the worst ever recorded by a new British Prime Minister. According to the survey, some 64% of British voters disapprove of Liz Truss and how she is handling her job, while only 16% approve, leading to an overall approval rating of 47%. Equally unpopular among Brexit supporters and opponents, a majority of voters, or 53%, think Liz Truss should resign a mere month after taking office. Liz Truss's dismal approval rating comes despite the new Prime Minister delivering a keynote speech at the Conservative Party annual conference in Birmingham. Such events usually give leaders a boost in the polls as they get a chance to explain their political platform to a receptive crowd.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.